A micropayments system assumes a solution to the mental accounting problem. If somebody could actually solve this problem, rather than merely claiming to have solved it via some mysterious means, intelligent agents at all, the savings would be enormous, even in existing business, such as the long distance and internet service, not to mention all the new possibilities. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. This show is brought to you by the Human Rights Foundation and their incredible work in detailing out and staying in touch on the news and with the people on the ground for the fight for human freedom around the world. Their Financial Freedom Report is one of the best resources I have had on this topic. You can subscribe to the newsletter and check out their other amazing work in the details right in the show notes. And also, if you have not read it, Alex Gladstein has the Check Your Financial Privilege, which is such a fantastic book, and I was honored to do the narration for it. So if you want to grab it on Audible, you will hear my lovely, beautiful voice reading that amazing book to you. And this is also brought to you by BitKit and Synonym, the makers of PubKey. They've built a new system for a decentralized DNS on top of BitTorrent. And I've been testing out the beta and using it back and forth kind of between Noster. It's just a really cool and promising project. And the other thing they made is the BitKit wallet, which is one of my favorite wallets. It is a non-custodial on-chain and Lightning wallet. And if you want one that just has a beautiful flow, excellent design, and it just works, if you haven't tried BitKit, you're making a big mistake. All right. All the details for our sponsors and everything are right down there in the show notes, and as well as some great places to buy Bitcoin, to listen and boost this on Fountain. So many great resources and some other affiliates, some homeschooling stuff too. I highly recommend you read the description if you have not seen all of the goodies. All right, today we are actually bringing it back. We got a piece from 1996. It's an old Nick Szabo piece, and it's one that I had not thought about this concept a whole lot until Nick Szabo, one of the pieces. This is similar to a piece that we read a million years ago, which I can't even remember what I can't remember the title exactly, but this one's very, very similar to it. It's about the mental transaction cost. Is what is the lower bound on a microtransaction, and what are kind of the dynamics involved? Because it's not so simple as like, oh, we can have this ripe and huge environment of if we just solve the transaction cost problem. Now that we have Lightning, we can trade things at 1 sat and 10 sats and 25 sats and over again. We have all these markets for all of these little tiny products and services and goods. And it will be robust and massive because obviously it's small and easy and transactions are cheap. So now we can do this and all of this new stuff exists. Well, there might be a bigger and more fundamental barrier to that than a lot of people are recognizing. And I think revisiting this is really interesting in the context of Noster and value for value and Zaps, because now we have the infrastructure. Now we have the network. Now we have the environment in which we can really recreate and rethink about how these monetization models work. And I don't want to lose sight of really important truths. So with that, I'm gonna let Szabo take it away. We will read this piece and then we will hit Guy's take to follow it up. So let's dive into our article, and it's titled "The Mental Accounting Barrier to Micropayments" by Nick Szabo, written in 1996. Some electronic commerce projects promise dramatically lower transaction costs so that we can achieve, quote, micropayments or micro-intermediation and so forth. An even more advanced idea is the use of very small granularity markets for the allocation of computer and network resources. To what extent are such things achievable? Consider a feature fairly independent of the particular payment system, the statement of charges. Here lies a trade-off between completeness and complexity. On the one hand, merely summarizing charges creates the opportunity for salami frauds, allowing widely distributed false or exaggerated microcharges to go undetected. Furthermore, parties reading only the summaries get no feedback by which they can adjust their behavior to minimize costs. On the other hand, a statement too complex for customers to read also allows fraud, error, and inefficient usage to go undetected, because one or both parties cannot understand the rationale for the charges in relation to the presumed agreement in terms of service and payment. The same kind of reasoning applies to working these things out in the head instead of on paper, as is often done in small cash transactions. A basic requirement for market pricing to work is that both sides to a transaction be able to map charges to value obtained or rendered, so that they can adjust their buying or selling behavior accordingly. There seems to be a fundamental cognitive bottleneck. One proposed solution to this has been, quote, intelligent agents, but since these agents are programmed remotely, not by the consumer, it is difficult for the consumer to determine whether the agent is acting in the consumer's best interest or in the best interest of the counterparty. Perhaps necessarily at least as difficult as reading the corresponding full statement of charges. Furthermore, the user interface to enable consumers to simply express their sophisticated preferences to an agent is lacking and may represent another fundamental cognitive bottleneck. Communications companies have found billing to be a major bottleneck. By some estimates, up to 50% of the costs of a long-distance call are for billing, and this is on the order of a $100 billion per year market worldwide. Internet providers have been moving to a flat fee in order to minimize these costs, even though this creates the incentive for network resource overusage. A micropayments system assumes a solution to the mental accounting problem. If someone could actually solve this problem rather than merely claiming to have solved it via some mysterious means, intelligent agents at all, the savings would be enormous even in existing business, such as long distance and internet service, not to mention all of the new possibilities possible by lowering transaction costs. Example: electricity bills. Sometimes statements account for transactions in gratuitously small increments, such as the 100 watt-hour resolution on some electricity bills. There are plenty of things most folks normally don't work out regarding their electricity bills, which could improve the value they get for their electricity payments. Which appliance are using more electricity with less personal benefit? Not available on the electricity bill, but one can conceive of a personal accounting program tied to smart appliances that let you do this. How to better balance electric versus gas heat. You could compute this in detail and save a few bucks, but you'd earn extra money faster by moonlighting. If the electricity company was a less reliable and widely known entity, you also might not trust them with the billing and would recompute it to the resolution you felt comfortable with, and accept fraud or fine print trickery below that level. Since electricity is fungible and the pricing rule set small, you can have a program check the bill, which is efficient if it catches enough fine print shenanigans for enough people to recoup software development and marketing costs. The reason we don't do these things is that they're not worth the brain cycles. We have reached the mental accounting barrier. A theory of price granularity. Here I present briefly a theory of price granularity based on a subjectivist view of prices. The function of prices from the point of view of a shopper is to let the shopper map his personal resources, budget, to his personal values, unique and not directly observable. This mental process requires comparison of the purchase price of a good to its personal value. This entails a significant mental cost, which sets the most basic lower bounds on transaction costs. For example, comparing the personal value of a large, diverse set of low-priced goods might require a mental expenditure greater than the prices of those goods, where mental expenditure may be measurable as the opportunity costs of not engaging in mental labor for wages or of not shopping for a fewer number of more comparable goods with lower mental accounting costs. In this case, it makes sense to put the goods together into bundles with a higher price and an intuitive synergy until the mental accounting costs of shoppers are sufficiently low. These mental accounting costs, not the physical or computational or amortized R&D costs of payment or billing method, set the main lower bound on price granularity. Judging from pricing granularity trends, such as the trend towards flat rates in online services, online pricing granularity is far above suggested micropayment levels of a few cent or even fractions of a cent. The mental accounting costs for a typical online consumer seem to be somewhat higher than those in more familiar areas of commerce. One possible fix is for the shopper's software to compare purchase prices against a, quote, consumer reports service, but such unbiased information is rare, and in any case takes into account only widely shared values, not personal values. Another fix is possible for fungible commodities. Charge a fixed price per unit, which the shopper can evaluate from just the accumulated number of units and price information. As a concrete example, in a current U.S. ad campaign, AT&T is betting that its 15-cent flat rate is more attractive than Sprint's 10-cent to who knows what variable rate, that it is worth the vendor foregoing congestion pricing and the shopper foregoing deep discounts in order to have a predictable rate, turning phone time into a fungible commodity, and thus saving on mental accounting costs. Alas, most internet commerce is not fungible. Content, services, mail order products, and so on. Some internet service provider, or ISP services, can be sold as fungible, for example disk space or connection time, only at the expense of foregoing congestion pricing and other pricing methods that, if it were not for mental accounting costs, might be quite efficient. Furthermore, even for fungible commodities, each user has a unique curve of diminishing returns. Software would have to let the shopper determine and input his volume preference curve in some intuitively familiar way without presupposing the shopper is familiar with economic theory before it could adequately act in his interests, not to mention the complications of temporal preferences, nonlinear interactions between commodities fungible when in isolation, and so on. This user interface solution for the case of fungible commodities suggests a better strategy for tackling the more general problem of mental accounting in online commerce. Develop better ways for the shopper to communicate his personal preferences to software. Marketers have long devised schemes to get this kind of information, detailed surveys, tracking of user behavior and responses, etc. Arguably, web services like www.firefly.com are the most advanced in this regard. Firefly creates a kind of subjective space of musical preferences in which the shopper can navigate and find new music that they are more likely to prefer. Given that software can represent certain preferences, it is a more straightforward problem for software to map these representations to specific prices or bids, engage in shopping or haggling, and securely complete online transactions. These easier problems have been the focus of micropayments research, but the more fundamental problem of obtaining and representing preferences in the first place have gone largely unrecognized, perhaps due to an objectivist bias that posits mathematical laws rather than subjective preferences as the basis of a working economy. Given the solution of other transaction cost problems, mental accounting costs that become subject to the limit on the process of communicating preferences, whether via the mental accounting choice of one good over another, or through creating a unique and sufficiently accurate software simulacrum and purchasing process, to what extent and with what efficiency can A, a shopper communicate subjective preferences to software, and B, can software represent and act in the interest of these objectified preferences? The presence of search engines, catalog order forms, marketing surveys, and more sophisticated interactions like Firefly demonstrate that such communication and representation is both feasible and important, but seems to be costly and perhaps fundamentally limited in some way. Preferences and visual metaphors. To assess the desirability of a transaction and to avoid being mischarged, the parties to a transaction have to count up, i.e. account for, the money paid for particular products and services, whether making sure that cash payments are made as promised, for example looking at the display as products are scanned at the store, or the receipt afterwards, or making sure the phone bill is proper. Herein I use accounting in this broad sense. I may be paying in cash, but I'd still like to keep track of how and why my cash is going in and out, for many of the same reasons that accountants reconcile and analyze book entries. Right now, a transaction log, whether e-cashes or a credit cards, is the most useful way to do this. There may be other metaphors more appropriate for some circumstances. For example, absolute level gauges, rate gauges with high and low watermarks, etc. This is a potentially fertile new field to explore. There may be agents that can do some of the accounting. For example, comparing payments made to terms promised, payment limits, etc. But for the vast majority of products and services, software cannot judge the quality or personal desire for the product or service, and thus the net desirability of the transaction. The user must undertake this comparison with whatever information the computer can provide via the display. The user interface and the cognition of the user thus remain the bottleneck to transaction granularity. A big task is to use the power of the graphical user interface to come up with new metaphors to make this easier. It is the intuitive yet accurate metaphor that will lower accounting costs. Cryptographic protocols potentially lower only security-related transaction costs, such as forgery and extortion. For the normal accounting transaction costs, which are currently too high for micropayments, we need better interactive visual metaphors. For transactions free of records, we need transactions that can be fairly transacted once, immediately accounted for by the parties via a nice visual metaphor, then forgotten. The potential for unresolvable disputes in record-free systems is vast for transactions where this is not possible, probably most of desired commerce, where quality of a product or service cannot be well determined until after the purchase transaction is complete, or where credit is involved. Price is one kind of contractual term. We also need nice metaphors to keep track of the other kinds of contractual terms. Lack of observability of the protocol on the part of the user leads to the ability of the counterparty to engage in hidden actions. See smart contracts, building blocks for digital markets for further discussion of this and other computerized contracting issues. One of the barriers to creating good contracts is determining what the parties want in the first place. People tend to think in terms of standard or stereotyped conditions. Payment in dollars, investing in stocks, etc. When there exists a far wider variety of alternative contractual structures that, combined properly, could better meet the parties' needs. I'd like to see tools which allow parties to explore their desires interactively with the computer. In finance, this might include interactive personal yield curves, determining the partial order of desires, as in decision theory, for particular alternate securities, derivatives and synthetics, and so on. Software would then analyze this input, make recommendations, and even undertake automated contracting. Metaphors should be developed to make it easy for lay users to express such desires without extensive knowledge of finance or decision theory. Such metaphors would provide a friendly front end to automated exchanges, auctions, and other online contracting mechanisms. Currently, budget programs like Quicken provide some of the metaphors, and financial analysis programs provide extensive feedback on the cash flow properties of particular contracts, but a potentially large, untapped market lies between in a combination of these two technologies. All right, so there's a couple of different reasons why I wanted to bring this piece back, which we haven't covered it on the show, but there's one that Nick Szabo did similar to this one on the whole idea of mental transaction costs. But with the adoption and the environment of Nostr, and kind of seeing what micropayments actually are, and then also seeing streaming sats and that sort of thing explored in Fountain, I think it's a useful exercise to go back through and think about what has succeeded and or has still been a barrier for those types of environments and those types of monetary interactions with Bitcoin. And then also in thinking about new monetization models, is not getting overly attached to or failing to recognize the barriers to the seemingly tiny payments, because there is no micropayment really. Because as Szabo says, the lower bound is the ability to compare that payment according to personal values against alternatives, which has a mental barrier. It has a mental cost that limits how granular and how small any transaction can actually be. So using the example that he talked about bringing up is just, well, what if there's like 100 different options of very similar but varied and slightly different priced like micro goods, right? Well, if we're talking about something that's a penny, a 20 cent, even a dollar, really, and, you know, we're like going off and reading reviews and trying to compare, like, what are the stats on this thing? Like, I'm looking at, you know, how much RAM and CPU does this computer have, kind of thing. Like, I'm shopping. Shopping is a process. Shopping is a kind of sophisticated process, actually, for making an assessment of what the information is about the product that you're going to be receiving. Like, you can be a crappy shopper. You know, you could have someone who is looking at two TVs and says, oh, well, this one's only 1080p while this one's 2K. And they just don't know that that's the same thing. It's just a different branding for, you know, 1920 by 1080, because for some reason we just switched to 4K when we doubled that. Sounds better in the ad, I guess. And it's also just, you kind of have a mental accounting barrier. It's like, okay, well, how does this relate to the last one? 4K is one number and one letter. And it's just kind of a nice side effect that it seems to be four times as good as 1080p. There is a lot of skill and knowledge required to actually get a good deal, because you have to know what the, not only what your personal taste and values and preferences are, but what the terms of the deal understand. You know, you think about it, like, everything is basically like buying an insurance contract with just the variant in details and visibility into what the contract means. Like, the contract that you have with the TV, you feel like you can at least see most of it, but you can't with the details of an insurance contract or a payment plan or interest rate. And most people don't understand interest at all, which makes them terrible shoppers when it comes to financing something or taking out debt. So just because you have a technical solution to some sort of, you know, granular payment problem, or pay per minute to listen to something, or buy all these tiny little things, like, it gets to a point where if you're having to make comparison, if it's not some sort of fungible thing, like, that's the good thing about like a pay per API call or something like that, is that you could have a fungible item that you're purchasing. Using the electricity bill that Szabo brought up as the example, is you have some very specific thing that you are purchasing per some very explicit amount, and every single time you interact with it, it's the exact same thing. That's like streaming sats or, you know, pay per minute, whatever it is. But also notice, most people like to, especially when it comes to like AI inference, is a really interesting one, because you don't know exactly how many tokens you're going to get, like how many words or paragraphs or how much deep research is going to occur. So if you're just paying per computation, how do I have any idea that the question I'm about to answer is either going to produce, you know, a 20 cent answer or a $7 answer? which is exactly why the subscription model is so unbelievably popular. It takes away those mental transaction costs. But I also think it's being applied to a bunch of things that don't need a subscription model, and it's been aggressively overused because they're trying to take advantage of people not being good at that mental accounting. However, what I find interesting is that I don't have this problem with the social side of Noster when I'm just zapping. And I think it makes sense just because I don't have to think about comparing my social interactions. I don't have to, you know, if I'm trying to think of, like, going back to the idea of the comparing 100 different variant tiny things that are between one penny and like 50 cent, like I'm not going to spend any time on that. Like, I'm not even going to bother trying to shop or figure out what all the terms mean if I don't know that. I'm not even going to read them. I might just, if I'm trying to get something that solves some sort of a problem or that I can interact with right now, I'm just going to kind of buy something and use that. And if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work. I'll maybe get another one. Maybe I'll just walk away from this whole thing entirely and look for some sort of a platform that has the thing included. And that's really where I think a lot of this sort of thinking goes, is when you have something that's so small as to make it silly, because the person trying to price the thing is also having the same problem. How do you price something in such a way that the user doesn't just like, what is this? Why am I don't even want to go here. You know, it's like adding two extra steps into like logging in or creating a profile or something. It just annoys people. When you're doing something, you're getting some sort of a benefit, or you're going somewhere for some experience or social environment or entertainment, the last thing you want is a bunch of paperwork, kind of, you know, the kind of like mental paperwork and the idea of trying to like stress out or make decisions. Like, a lot of people will do things to relax or to solve some sort of a problem specifically to avoid having to make a whole bunch of complicated or annoying decisions. So that's why a bunch of tiny little features or additions just kind of get added in. You know, when you look at like a subscription service or something that's, you know, like a podcast hosting service or whatever it is online, you'll get the free version or the low cost version that just kind of has like the core. Like, these are the three things that you're really kind of looking for. And then the next tier up is like twice as expensive. Let's say the first one's like $10. The next one's $20. And it's the quote unquote popular one when you see it in the list. But they basically add all of those extra little features that you would never know what to charge exactly for. It's like, oh, I'm going to have go back to podcast hosting as the example. I'll add in transcriptions and then it'll make chapters for you. And you can have dynamic ad insertion or whatever it is. And there's just like this bullet point list of like these 10 other things that you get. And so all you have to do is compare the general overview of what those things are and what you think you'll use versus the basic, like, oh, I just need a place to store my podcast. There's a reason why all of those things aren't itemized out, where you don't add 99 cent for transcription or $1.50 for auto file conversion, or 20 cent in order to do custom images for every single thing. Like, it would just be infuriating, and you might even be able to get it more efficient. You might be able to granularize, like, maybe I don't want to change the image every single time I do an episode. I don't need that. I can save 20 cent here. But now I'm immediately trying to build this like big elaborate kind of like custom configuration set that I'm not even 100% sure I'm going to need. So, you know, in 3 weeks I might realize that, oh, I actually would like to change the image of this one because, I don't know, somebody really big is on the show. Dave Smith is going to be on the show. It's like, oh, well, let's put him on the image so that people can see that Dave Smith is on the show in the feed. Well, now I got to go back and add 20 cent to my plan and change the configuration detail, blah, 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 right? Now there's this huge, ridiculous burden about a bunch of things that don't matter that much themselves. Now, another thing I found interesting about this piece is that he brings up the idea of agents. And this is 1996. There were no AI agents, right? There was no chatbot back then. He's just thinking of like software that can potentially have some sort of a simple algorithm for making that assessment. And I find it kind of interesting that algorithms have basically done this for us, but they've been centralized algorithms that have tried to push stuff in front of us that they think we're going to buy, or push interactions which are going to keep us, you know, rage baited to stay on Twitter or whatever it is. So these agents have largely been in use. Szabo used a Firefly as the example of like a music recommendation, which obviously you now get in all sorts of things. You get Netflix recommendations based on what you watch, based on what the trailers you watch and which ones you continue. You watch the whole thing versus stop it versus how much you watch of each episode. They give you a prediction on which one you're probably going to like and which one you won't. Same thing with Amazon products and online. And you know, a lot of these things track you across your social media and track you across the internet to see what websites you go to, and then they stick those items in front of you. And there is a very sneaking and kind of, everybody says it's not true, but the coincidences just stack. The fact that it's a funny joke, because everybody has had the experience of saying something out loud during a conversation and then getting an advertisement or getting it recommended to them on Amazon or some other environment when they're using their phone next. Everybody feels like something's being recorded, like their phone is listening to them and adapting to their environment and the purchases that they want to make or the things that they say. Oh, they're talking about going on a vacation. What a coincidence that I just got a new notification from Airbnb about going to the mountains. It's like a lot of people are like, oh, that's not happening. But there's a reason why everybody laughs at that joke. Everybody knows that feeling. Everybody knows that sense that the phone and these corporations know you better than you know yourself, and that they are listening and taking in every little piece of information. And every one of you listening today knows, you have that story of, yes, we were talking about this thing in a personal conversation, and then boom, one of us got an ad for it, or it showed up in an email newsletter, or whatever. That's kind of where the idea of the agent has actually manifested. But in the age of AI, it's actually kind of interesting that this could change. But I'm not so sure it really solves the problem. I think a lot of people are hell-bent and like just totally convinced that AI is like we're gonna birth super intelligence or whatever. And I still don't. You know, there was the great piece by what was the one about the next 10 years? Ashenbrenner. Ashenbrenner was the author's name. I can't remember, but it's on AI Unchained, which you can find in this feed. I'll try to remember the name of it and dig it up. But I recommend you listen to that, because I went back and forth quite a bit about whether or not superintelligence was going to be created, and if the logic of a bigger model can create a smaller model that's more effective, and that can lead to, if you then compound or stack, you scale the training of that model, then that can make it better and better and better, bigger and bigger. And so big successful models can actually train bigger and better models without having to be or understand, like be smarter themselves in order to make a smarter one. Because being able to make a smaller, you can make a, from the same recipe, you can make a big model or you can make a small model. And if you make a small model, you could continue to add compute to that in order to make a big one. And so if you can do that, that means you can make two small models. And because it's necessarily smaller, quote unquote, dumber than the big model that's making them, well, then it can decide, it can basically test them all and say like, okay, well, this model on the right, let me tweak the recipe a little bit. Let me tweak the how we do this a little bit and retrain it or do some feedback learning, whatever it is, to get it to have better results. And now you have two different small models that both could just basically be fundamental recipes for a big model. And one of them has now been made better than the other because they're both dumber than the big model. However, if you then take the recipe of the better one, The recipe of the first one that's not as good is the recipe for the model itself, the big one that's making the assessment. And now if it can make the small version better, then it can compute and grow it into a big model, and now the big model is better than the original big model because it is simply derived from the little one. So that's kind of the logic behind it and why there is this idea that AI can train better AI. But I am not so... The piece was a very, very convincing argument. But I'm increasingly not so sure. I think there's a couple of different problems with that. One of the things that Zaba brings up in this piece is that it's all subjective. At some point, it is all subjective. There is only so much objectivity in the accuracy and in the value judgment of an AI model, because so many of our decisions and reasons to pick one over another are explicitly subjective reasons, which means you have to have a set of values and a set of preferences. And AI doesn't have that because that's not what AI is. AI just has probabilities. That is it. Then there's another problem, is that just because you have a small model, like, it does tend to work that way, but it is not certain that just because you can make a smaller model better than another smaller model, that the bigger model will 100%. There's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of unexpected things in apparently creating these models. There's a big degree of, it's kind of like image diffusion, is you use random seeds and some of your images might just suck. Well, apparently there's a bit of an art to creating models as well, from what I've heard in talking to people about it and in the challenges of creating them. Svetsky's shared a lot of this on the Spirit of Satoshi. But because of that, you don't really know. If you don't have a way to assess it, you don't have a way to value or judge the outputs of that model, then you don't 100% know that it's better than the other one. And the bigger and bigger you compound, the more you scale the compute, the higher the cost, and I believe we're going to have a lower marginal return. The more and more compute we add, the lower and lower the marginal return is, for two different reasons. And one of them is deeply related to the whole mental transaction cost problem in this piece. The first reason is that how much actual capacity and variation can you get in the capabilities of small models that you can scale up? And when you are scaling up, it scales up exponentially. So you're needing bigger, like, these big models get really insane with the degree to which they need compute in order to keep them in RAM, to keep them in memory, to make them viable. Whereas we're already using a ton of other mechanisms to make smaller models or make specialized models and have them interact with each other, which I think is going to be the far better approach overall. It's not going to be just one big, giant, ridiculous model. But then the other one is in judgment, is in how do you know this one is better than the other one? And importantly, if it costs twice as much in compute, like if you're charging me twice as much to use this model, as going to the idea of superintelligence, if you're asking me to pay 10 times as much for the one that's super intelligent versus pay 10% to the one that's just like the smartest human I've ever met, okay, well, how the hell do I know the difference? Why would I value the super intelligent model's output 10 times more than the one that's already smarter than me? And how do I know it's 10 times better? I've now reached this kind of other limit of not even having enough information or values or intelligence to compare these things to each other. So why does it matter for me to use the more intelligent one? I actually think we hit a threshold, because the model itself is never going to have a subjective preference. It's not going to have judgment. You have to be mortal to have judgment, to have values. So it's simply not going to know or care why something would be, like, one model would be better than another model. And from the human standpoint, from the user standpoint, it's like computer graphics that are already perfect. Okay, so this one's like a little bit better, And this is exactly what we saw. Like, so what we have right now is this period of like hyper growth and hyper, like doing everything you can to get the better model. My model's better. The benchmarks are better. Everything's better. It's bigger. This one's bigger. This one's more available. This one's got all the bells and whistles. And this one does code better and all this crap. And it's over and over and over again. Everything's just push it to its limit. How can we make it bigger? How can we make it better? How can we make it more intelligent? Super intelligence is anywhere around the corner. That same thing happened in video games and computer graphics with PlayStation, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, Xbox, Nintendo, all of these things for 10, 15 years. Like, that was the only thing. Every single time there was a new conference and there were new games and there was a new gaming console, look at the graphics. Holy crap. 2D to 3D. Holy crap. 3D to like hyper detailed. Holy crap. To look at the cutscenes in this. Man, this looks cinematic. Oh my God, you can see the beads of sweat on the characters. It was the thing for like 15 years. And then it stopped being a spectacle. It just got good enough that it didn't really matter. And the next one that spent, you know, put 10 times as much GPU power to get like better graphics for the PlayStation 4 and showing off the cutscenes and stuff. The graphics were like a little bit better. The physics engines were better and all this stuff, but it just didn't have the return because nobody could judge it. Nobody could care. It really still just kind of looked like Final Fantasy X looked pretty dope. And so what happened? The entire industry changed. The marketing and the marginal return on the graphics fight just kind of vanished, and now people were looking for, like, well, how can we apply that? How can we make more expansive games? How can we put more freedom in games? How can we create an environment where people just want to come back and play over and over and over again, where they're playing socially? Everybody's getting your massive multiplayer online games. The terms of what people valued completely shifted, and everybody stopped really caring about graphics. Graphics just had to be good enough. And then it went fully into the background until retro graphics were actually a thing in of themselves. It was actually a cool game because it had bad graphics or unique graphics or a unique art style. And I honestly think that's what's going to happen with the fidelity of AI agents and stuff. And in the context of this paper and on the microtransaction costs concept is, not only do I think the idea of judgment and like trying to compare those micro differences or invisible to the user differences for a quote unquote super intelligent model, not only do I think that's relevant, but then also in the reverse is the model's still never going to be able to make subjective decisions on your behalf. Like the whole concept of like having an experience is about the experiencing being on you, and that you're like an example of why I don't think a machine will ever be making financial decisions for me outside of the concept of, you know, doing decent accounting and trading or buying fungible items on my behalf, which would, like, electricity, right? I just pay for electricity. If there was a cheaper way to get electricity at some point in time and an AI agent could do that for me, that's perfectly fine, because I'm still just going to use the electricity. My thing over here is running right now, some AI stuff at this very moment. It's using up electricity. I am not counting that shit. But in the terms of like which music I want to buy or listen to, or what's going to be like, those things change every day. Those things change by the hour. I might be in a particular mood and want a subjective payment. And the whole idea, I don't think AI, I mean, sure, I bet some stupid people for some reason just want to avoid life altogether, and they put their brain in a jar and they let computers make all their decisions for them. But I don't think that will be the overwhelming majority of, I think that will be depressed people largely. I think most people want to live their life. They want to be the ones in the driver's seat making decisions. And I think that's generally the case, except for when it is trained out of people, literally by a bad education system and by a bad financial system that makes them dependent and trapped. But I just do not think there will ever be a time in which, like, subjective means singular to your perspective and experience, and you cannot have AI experience things for you. You cannot have it know your experience so in such an in-depth way outside of it being you. that it can then make subjective decisions on your perspective and environment and emotion and all of those things. So I thought this idea is worth really kind of exploring again and keeping fresh in everybody's minds, because we are changing how monetization happens. And we are changing that interaction. Going back to the idea I was talking about the Noster, and how I don't have a lot of those mental transaction problems when I'm interacting and zapping on Noster, is because I've already had the experience, and I've already had the quote unquote, I've already gotten the product. I've already gotten the product when I'm deciding how to zap somebody. And I don't have any like, oh, I'm trying to judge, is this better than this other thing? Because I'm just in the moment making the decision about how funny or how enjoyable or how much I agree with this statement. Bam, this is 210 sats. Holy shit, that's 1,000 sats. Thank you for that one. I cannot believe that I did not know about that fantastic detail or information. And I can also just throw out, like, there's this element of organic nature to it when, you know, you can just toss out, like, who is it worth 1,000 sats to find me this link or this YouTube video? And rather than this market where there's tons of varied or chaotic, like, goods and services all over at tiny prices and all this stuff, it's more of a feedback mechanism to things that have already been experienced and interactions that have already occurred. And that's a really interesting thing about why value for value, I think, seems to have a pretty decent hold in the Noster environment, and why it may have a really strong future still and could grow to a huge degree. And it's also important to understand and think about how and where the subscription model is still best, and obscuring away the granular costs of a whole bunch of stupid little things and just kind of like packaging it up, because, you know, that's a lot of the problem, is just like getting away from all of this, people needing to account for and deal with how many little things do I have, and how much am I using this thing, and to think more about that, more about that user experience, and that is an always present thing, so that we don't spend a whole lot of time or waste a whole lot of time trying to create pricing models or payment granularity that never actually makes sense from the outset. But in one additional and interesting piece, or an element, is the idea of when we do have AI agents working, AI may be able to do this between each other, which would be interesting. But it's funny, you may actually have the exact same, you may run into the same barrier. You may run into the negotiating or trying to find a better price on these tokens is costing me tokens to make the assessment. You know, the AI model has to run itself in order to find the better price or the better output from another model, and maybe it doesn't make accounting sense to go through all that effort to keep computing what the relative value of this one versus this one is when it's just a 2 sat difference. So it could literally even be possible that this doesn't even work in the context of AI agents paying each other, and it still makes more sense. It could even make sense to continue to actually assess or establish markets based on trust. Trust may still end up being the better model for establishing business and online relationships in something like Noster. You use your web of trust because, you know, what does it matter whether your AI has found a slightly better, more price efficient one, if you also now have to judge whether or not you trust this person to do that computation, or maybe you have to trust with whether or not you think they don't have the information that you're sending and you're computing in a black box, but do you really know that? There is always a risk to their being connected to them and the data that you are giving them, and the data that they can pull or assess from you and your connection and your metadata and all of that. So there may be a lower bound in all of these different contexts, and it's important to keep in mind. I think it's a really, really important topic, and concept to hold on to when we're trying to come up with new monetization systems and new ideas for how to price and how to make things profitable and sustainable when we're talking about open protocols and we don't have, and the advertising model, which I think most of us really want to change. I think it's recognized that that's a huge problem that needs a solution. And it's important that we don't lose sight of what may be fundamental realities in the effort to solve that problem. So with that, thank you guys so much for listening. Don't forget to check out the Human Rights Foundation and their amazing financial freedom report. Link to the newsletter to stay up on the human rights fight around the world and Bitcoin as a technology for freedom is right down there in the show notes. And check out the BitKit on-chain and Lightning wallet, non-custodial. You hold your keys and it just works. And I will catch you on the next Bitcoin Audible. And until then, everybody, that's my two sats. I am not in this world to live up to your expectations, and you're not in this world to live up to mine. Bruce Lee.